This evening's lesson will come from the book of Judges, chapter 9. If you were at our Bible reading on Tuesday, this lesson actually is directly inspired from the reading that we had there. I was originally planning to preach on something else. I actually have sermon ideas planned out about 3 months in advance ordinarily, but that list is subject to change, which is why I never show it to anybody. So as far as you know, I've been planning this for months and months. Judges chapter 9, we're looking at the story of Abimelech, which is kind of an anomaly in the Judges overall. Normally, when you read about characters in the book of Judges, what happens is there's this, the people of Israel get themselves into some kind of apostasy, some kind of mess, and the Lord responds by punishing them and sending a foreign nation to go and oppress them. And then, after they serve that nation for a while, the people get really upset, and they cry out to the Lord, and they say how sorry they are that they served all those idols. And the Lord hears their cry, and He raises up a deliverer to save them from this oppressive foreign nation. Someone we would call a judge. And then after that deliverer saves them, then everything is wonderful, and the land has rest, and it's all peaceful, until the judge dies. And then Israel goes back to their evil, idolatrous, idol-serving ways once again. Sometimes they don't wait for the judge to die. They just go straight back into apostasy without that prompting even. But Abimelech is kind of an anomalous character in that he's not really, he doesn't really deliver the nation, and they don't really go through that cycle. Abimelech is just kind of this very lengthy narrative inserted in Judges chapter 9, and really kind of the low point of the book in many ways, not including the ending, which is really bad, but the low point in the book of Judges where Abimelech is, decides to become king and does a real hack job of it. You think of Israel's king. So who was Israel's first king? Some people say King David, but that's wrong. And some people will say King Saul, and you think that's right, but it's actually not. Israel's first king was a guy named Abimelech, who was a really bad king, and couldn't even really get a lot of territorial control, it seems like, and winds up dying in a manner very similar to Saul, actually. Let's look at Abimelech. He was the son of Gideon. Well, we know all about Gideon, the judge in Judges chapter 6 through 8. Who tore down his father's altar to Baal, and who earned himself the name Jerubbaal, which means let Baal contend. He defeated the Midianites with a super, super tiny army of only 300 men. But Gideon wasn't a perfect man. He had some issues, and especially towards the end of his life, you see some rather hypocritical behaviors emerging in Gideon's behavior. I think what we need to know about the end of Gideon's life is summed up by this idea in chapter 8. When the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." So what Israel wants is they want to make Gideon their king, and they want it to be kind of a dynastic leadership where, Gideon's son is also king, and his son's son is also king, kind of finally have a king in Israel. And Gideon says something. He says to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." And on the surface, that sounds pretty good. And in fact, it's kind of the same thing that God's talking about in 1 Samuel chapter 8. When the people ask for a king, He tells Samuel that the people have not rejected you. They've rejected me from being king over them. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 7. But, of course, as is so often in the Bible, sometimes what a character says is not consistent with what they do. And that's definitely true of Gideon. Because the first thing Gideon does immediately after saying is, "I'm not going to be your king," is, "Oh, but I do want you all to give me gold." So he collects a gold earring from each of them, which he then makes into an ephod, which then ensnares the people, and they play the harlot with it, which is a roundabout way of saying they were worshiping it. And then we learn a little bit later in chapter 8 that Gideon had 70 sons who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives. And if I were to ask you a basic history question in the ancient world, what class of people usually had a bunch of wives enough to produce 70 sons? And if you said kings, you would be right. That is what kings did in the ancient world. So Gideon's not king, he's sure acting like one. And perhaps the real clincher, for me anyway, is that Gideon has a concubine who lives in Shechem, in verse 31, and she bears him a son, and the son's name is Abimelech, which the name Abimelech, translated, means, "My father is king." So Gideon tells the people, oh, I'm not going to be your king. And then he names one of his sons, my father is king. You tell me what he really thought. Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a ripe old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. And it came about as soon as Gideon was dead that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they so show kindness to the household of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in accordance with all the good that he had done to Israel. So here now we have some kind of a fallout going on. With Gideon dead, Israel has come full circle. His life begins by tearing down Baal's altar, only to have Baal-berith come back, Baal of the Covenant. And it looks like, you know, let Baal contend. Well, looks like Baal has successfully contended for himself, we might say. Which, you know, raises all sorts of questions about God and what is God doing in this story. And, you know, I mean, you know, Joash made the point to the people after Gideon tore down his altar. He says, you don't need to contend for Baal. Baal will contend for himself. And lo and behold, by the end of the story, Baal's altar is back and Gideon is dead. And in fact, the name of the true God, Yahweh, is not mentioned at all, hardly at all in Judges chapter 9. It's always God, Elohim, instead of Yahweh. And this is with one exception, of course, and that is the name of the character Jotham, whose name means Yahweh is perfect, or Yahweh is honest. Gideon is only referred to as let Baal contend throughout the story, and God does not intervene in this story to save anybody. He only intervenes to destroy. But is God still active? Well, keep reading. It came about as Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and spoke to them and to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father, saying, speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. Which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbaal, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Also, remember, I am your bone and your flesh. You see what he's doing there. Abimelech shows up here. He calls together these men of Shechem, the leaders of Shechem, literally the Baals of Shechem, actually, because the word Baal can mean lord or master or something like that. So herein, again, Abimelech is calling a meeting of the Baals of Shechem, and he asks this question, which is better? And this statement, the whole statement he makes, assumes that Gideon's sons were in fact intended to rule. Which is better, 70 men ruling over you or just one guy? Which is better, have Congress or president? Hey, look at me. I can solve all your problems without any of that fancy deadlock, without having to having to go to any meetings. Well. Oh, and by the way, I'm the best choice because I'm related to you guys. Those other sons of Gideon, they don't live in Shechem. They don't know the issues that you deal with here. They don't have the problems and the struggles. They don't know you like I know you. You should make me your king. And we should get rid of these other sons of Gideon so that you don't have 70 men contending for the throne. And so just as Israel had made a covenant with Baal in chapter 8 and verse 33, Abimelech makes a covenant with the Baals of Shechem. And they are swayed by the fact that he is related to them. It is an opportunistic nepotism. Gideon may have had a chance of becoming king, but of his sons, well, only Abimelech's going to make Shechem into the seat of power. So what happens in verse 3? His mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the Baals of Shechem, all the leaders of Shechem, and they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our relative. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. And then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the son of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. All the men of Shechem and all Beth Miloth assembled together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar which was in Shechem. Abimelech's campaign for king is funded by the Baal cult. His father tore down his grandfather's Baal altar, but Abimelech has no problem building his new kingdom on such an idolatrous foundation. And 70 pieces of silver, why, that's more than adequate price to kill 70 brothers. the price of hiring hitmen in the ancient world, apparently. Now, what happens? He recruits an army of empty and reckless fellows and kills his brothers, eliminating all of his rivals for the throne of Israel. But of course, the fact that they would have even been considered rivals, again, you know, it goes back to the fact there's this assumption. Gideon's king and all the sons are going to be king too. That assumption's in there. Abimelech uses his maternal kinsmen to destroy his paternal kinsmen, effectively. And, I mean, you know, there can be no mistaking his villainous intentions here. He's only been on the scene for 5 verses, and he's already joined the ranks of our favorite biblical characters, like Cain, and Absalom, and Jehoram, guys who kill their brothers. In 1 John chapter 3, the Apostle John writes this concerning those who kill their brothers. He said that this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the evil one and slew his brother. And for what reason did he slay him? Because his deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous. Cain was of the evil one. He is a descendant of the devil. He is a child of Satan. He is the seed of the serpent. And why is Cain all of those things? Because he killed his brother. Watch out. Anytime in the Bible somebody kills their brother, it means they are the seed of serpent. In fact, that seems to be the whole point throughout the book of Genesis. There's a lot of guys in Genesis that are constantly conspiring to kill their brothers. Esau conspires to kill his brother Jacob. Joseph's brothers conspire to kill him at one point. Only Cain is in the book of Genesis is actually successful at it. But the whole idea is that someone who kills their brother, not the seed of woman through whom the promise comes, but the seed of the serpent, the seed of the devil. You want to know how we can tell your spiritual DNA? You want to know how we can tell whether somebody is a child of God or an obvious child of the devil? Well, one very obvious symptom, according to John, is whether or not one loves one's brother or one tries to kill one's brother. This is what Abimelech's actions mean. Shechem crowns Abimelech king. With no other rivals left, Abimelech now rules the nation from Shechem. Now, how much of Israel really recognized his rule is a matter of some debate. And, you know, so you might say, well, Abimelech's not really the first king because all Israel doesn't recognize his rule. And that might be true, but then you can't count Saul either because, you know, Saul doesn't really appear to have had that much territorial sway when it's all said and done. You know, he seems to have really kind of struggled to keep the whole nation behind him. But that's another issue. Shechem crowns Abimelech king. Shechem was kind of located in the middle of Israel. It was in the tribe of Ephraim, which kind of regarded itself as the best tribe. You know, they were son of Joseph, the favorite son, and Ephraim was the favorite son of Joseph. So it's kind of this whole business. Ephraim is always assuming that they're going to be first. Shechem is also located between two famous mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, the mountains of curse and blessing. And it is on the mountain of blessing that Jotham proclaims a curse on the people. In verse 7, when they told Jotham, he went and stood on the top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and called out. Thus he said to them, "Listen to me, O men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. Once the trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.' But the olive tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my fatness with which God and men are honored and go to wave over the trees?' Then the tree said to the fig tree, 'You, come, reign over us.' But the fig tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go to wave over the trees?' And then the tree said to the vine, 'You, come reign over us.' But the vine said to them, 'Shall I leave my new wine, which cheers God and men, and go to wave over the trees?' And finally, all the trees said to the bramble, 'You, come reign over us.' The bramble said to the trees, 'If in truth you are anointing me as king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon.' Now therefore, if you have dealt in truth and integrity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house, and you have dealt with him as he deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian, but you've risen against my father's house today and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his maidservant, king over the men of Shechem because he's your relative, have you dealt in truth and integrity with Jerubbaal and his household this day? Rejoice in Abimelech. Let him rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem and Beth Milo. And let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Beth Milo and consume Abimelech. And Jotham escaped and fled and went to Be'er and remained there because of Abimelech, his brother. And again, verse 21 kind of gives us a nice point about how, you know, Abimelech probably didn't control everywhere because, you know, he couldn't even extradite his brother out of Israel to have him executed after making this statement. Now, God doesn't speak in the narrative, but really, Jotham speaks for God when it's all said and done. And God, it's very clear by the end of the story that God is, in fact, bringing Jotham's words to fruition. Because in chapter 9 and verse 57, it says, God returned all the wickedness of the men of Shechem on their heads, and the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, came upon them. So God makes sure Jotham's words come to pass. And Jotham's parable is kind of interesting. This is one of the few times in the Old Testament we have an actual parable. Really almost a fable because you got talking trees in it. Jotham, he doesn't attack Abimelech directly. You know, it's kind of a roundabout criticism in a way. You know, he goes, you know, my brother's just the nastiest person in the world and, you know, he just killed all his brothers. Well, you know, he kind of, I mean, you could say a lot of bad things about Abimelech at this point. That's not what he does. He kind of goes after these people in a roundabout way and kind of pokes at them and says, you know, look how, you know, the parable is designed to expose just how ridiculous they have behaved in making Abimelech king. The trees want to make a king. And first they go to the most prized plants in the ancient world. The olive tree, the fig tree, the vine. Those are the things that people really thought, you know, the important plants that produce the useful crops. But the olive tree refuses because he would rather provide an oil and then be anointed with oil. The fig tree refuses. The vine refuses. We're too busy producing things, too busy producing olive oil and figs and grapes and wine. And the office of king is so worthless by comparison. Why would you leave productivity to engage in it? You know, there's something to the axiom that, you know, the people who desire power the least are probably the only ones qualified to have it. And then we come to the bramble. And that plant, you know what that plant does? It has contributed nothing to the rest of the world. People don't like brambles. You don't want to get caught in one. You certainly don't think of them as the place where you can go to get shade. But the bramble says, okay, yeah, sure. I'll be your king. You can nest in my shade. That's a terrible place to look for shade. Why would you do that? And the bramble says, no, but if you're not really serious about this, then fire is going to consume you. It's going to end badly for you. The bramble will become a source of judgment if the trees are just playing games. Now, strictly speaking, this fable is not identical to what has happened with Abimelech so far. I mean, you really want to analyze it and break down the symbolism. Abimelech sought to become king, whereas the trees are actively seeking out a king. Abimelech was the only candidate for king, whereas the trees talked to four different candidates, and they all kind of refused. And, you know, they had, you know, these trees aren't killing the other trees in order to get their king in place. And in fact, the situation that Jotham describes is actually better than the one currently underway under Abimelech. But Abimelech is like the bramble in this story. He is the worst place to seek refuge in. He himself is a worthless fellow. But all the other options have been exhausted because everybody else is dead. And Jotham says, you know, I mean, I hope it goes well with you if you've been dealing with Jerubbaal in faithfulness and kindness. And in the middle of saying, you know, if you've dealt with us in faithfulness and integrity, he inserts this long block of information about how they really haven't dealt with them in faithfulness and integrity by killing everybody in the family of the guy that just saved them from the Midianites. What happened? The Shechemites didn't make Abimelech king because they liked Gideon. They made him king because they liked themselves, because he's their relative, because they thought they could gain some kind of advantage. Well, he's on our side. Yeah, he's a total jerk, but at least he's on our side. Well, that's not going to work out well. If you've been dealing with Jerubbaal and his house in integrity, then rejoice in your new king, just like you would take refuge under a thorn bush. But if not, let fire come forth. Both Shechem and Abimelech are consumed here. In reality, they deserve each other. The wicked king will be destroyed by the people he rules, and the wicked people will be destroyed by the king that rules them. You've made your bed, now lie in it. Now, in verses 22 and following, we'll see how this reign of Abimelech turns out. He rules for 3 years. Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. Then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech so that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come and their blood might be laid on Abimelech their brother who killed them, and on the men of Shechem who strengthened the hands to kill his brothers. The men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all those who might pass by along the road. And it was told to Abimelech. All right, so what happens? Well, you know, he rules for 3 years. The text says he ruled over Israel for 3 years, but again, whether or not the nation recognized his rule is somewhat questionable. But this is Israel's first recorded attempt at the king. And then God sends his spirit. And this is something that happens a lot in the book of Judges. God, whenever God is about to raise up a judge to deliver Israel, he puts his spirit on him. The spirit of the Lord came on Gideon. The spirit of the Lord came on Othniel. The spirit of the Lord came on Jephthah. The spirit of the Lord comes on Samson more times than anybody in the book. Well, here, a spirit shows up, but it's a different kind of spirit. It's an evil spirit. Like God later sends an evil spirit to Saul in 1 Samuel 16. Here, God sends kind of this evil spirit, almost like a demon, if you will, that causes Abimelech and Shechem to destroy each other. So is God active in this story? Well, yeah, but he's active in a much different way. And verse 24 makes it clear that the reason that God is doing this is to avenge the blood of Gideon's sons. 70 innocent people died. I guess 69 innocent people died since you got Jotham who survives, but just like Abel's blood cried out for vengeance against Cain, the sons of Gideon's blood has similarly, the blood of the sons of Gideon has similarly cried out. God will avenge them. The men of Shechem, of course, in verse 25, we learn that they've set up an ambush for Abimelech. They're poised to betray him. But Abimelech finds out. And, well, what happens? Verse 26, Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his relatives and crossed over into Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their trust in him. They went out into the field and gathered the grapes of their vineyards and trod them and held a festival. And they went into the house of their God and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech. And then Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech? Who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal? And is not Zebul his lieutenant? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. Why should we serve him? Would therefore that this people were under my authority, and then I would remove Abimelech." And he said to Abimelech, "Increase your army and come out." Oh. So we got this guy named Gaal. He comes from outside of Shechem with his own relatives, and all of a sudden Shechem has a new local hero, backed by his family. And suddenly Abimelech isn't so important anymore. And you'll notice something, that the argument he makes towards the Shechemites as to why he should be the king instead of Abimelech is exactly the same as the argument that Abimelech was making. You know, "Well, I'm a closer relative." What happens when they find a closer relative? And people throw a big party, and because all drunken parties come with great ideas, they come with the great idea of revolting here. It takes place in the house of their God, and we're not talking about the true God here, we're talking about an idol shrine. And Gaal, well, he appeals to Shechem's identity, you know. Appeals to their nationalistic fervor. Shechem's a great city, and you know, we need to serve the men of Hamor and the father of Shechem. Why, Abimelech's not even here. He's not even serving Shechemite interests. "I am your bone and your flesh. Don't serve the son of Gideon. Don't serve the son of Jerubbaal. Serve the men of Shechem. I could do a better job. Would that this people were under my authority." And then a challenge for battle happens. Well, now, Abimelech's lieutenant, Zebul, is actually in Shechem when all this is going on. And in verse 30, when Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger burned. He sent messengers to Abimelech deceitfully, saying, "Behold, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his relatives have come to Shechem, and behold, they're stirring up the city against you. Now, therefore, arise by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. In the morning, as soon as the sun is up, you shall rise early and rush upon the city, and behold, when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you shall do to them whatever you can." So he passes this interest along. Abimelech's not using Shechem as his base of power. Notice how he's not really kept his promise to the Shechemites even. He's delegated his authority to Zebul. Zebul proposes this ambush. And then they fight each other. Verse 34, Abimelech and all the people who were with him arose by night, lay in wait against Shechem in the four companies. Now Gaal the son of Ebed went out and stood in the entrance of the city gate. And Abimelech and the people who were with him arose from the ambush. When Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, "Look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains." But Zebul said to him, "You are seeing the shadow of mountains as if they were men." Gaal spoke again and said, "Behold, people are coming down from the highest part of the land. One company comes by the way of the diviner's oak." And Zebul said to him, "Where's your boasting now, with which you said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him?' Is this not the people whom you despise? Go out now and fight with them." So Gaal went out before the leaders of Shechem and fought with Abimelech. Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him, and many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. Then Abimelech remained at Arumah, but Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not remain in Shechem. Now, and here we can just read the details of the battle. Abimelech camps against the city with his four companies. Gaal's watching from the gate. He spots Abimelech's army moving in the distance. Zebul at first tries to convince him, "Oh, you're just seeing shadows." When they get close enough, Zebul, it's like the unmasking at the end of an episode of Scooby-Doo. "Yo, where's your boasting now? Ha! It's really an army the whole time." And Gaal talked big at the party, but now you're faced with the reality of the forces closing in. And so Zebul goes out to fight, and he loses, and he has to flee. And Gaal and his relatives are forced to flee from Shechem. And it looks like Abimelech has won. You think, maybe Abimelech's proving to be a more competent ruler and putting down this rebellion, quashing it. And in fact, we keep reading, he destroys the city. It came about the next day that the people went out to the field. It was told to Abimelech. He took his people and divided them into three companies and lay in wait in the field. When he looked and saw the people coming out from the city, he rose against them and slew them. Then Abimelech and the company who was with them dashed forward, stood in the entrance of the city gate. The other two companies then dashed against all who were in the field and slew them. Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He captured the city and killed the people who were in it. Then he razed the city and sowed it with salt. "I am your flesh and your blood until it's time to destroy the city." Yeah. Oops. You shouldn't have revolted. You know, then apparently in verse 42, you know, suggests that the people in Shechem were just kind of trying to, you know, resume their normal life. They were going out into the fields, but Abimelech isn't going to have that. He takes three companies, kills the villagers, captures the gate, fights the city, captures it, kills its inhabitants, raises it to the ground, and sows it with salt. And the whole idea with that is, you know, fields were frequently sowed with salt in the ancient world to render them infertile. You can't grow any more crops there. In this case, the city is sown with salt. And it's probably a symbolic action to indicate that it would never rise again. In Deuteronomy 29, God describes Sodom and Gomorrah as a place of burning salt pits. You know, it's like God himself sowed those cities with salt to prevent them from ever being rebuilt. Verse 46, when all the leaders of the tower of Shechem heard it, they entered the inner chamber of the temple of El-Berith. It was told Abimelech that all the leaders of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. So Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people who were with him. Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a branch from the trees and lifted it and laid it on his shoulder. Then he said to the people who were with him, "What have you seen? What you've seen me do, hurry and do likewise." All the people also cut down each one his branch and followed Abimelech and put them on the inner chamber and set the inner chamber on fire over those inside, so that all the men of the tower of Shechem also died, about 1,000 men and women. And this whole business with raising the tower of Shechem, what's happened is Abimelech has taken the lower part of the city and destroyed that, but there's still a temple citadel that he needs to strike, and apparently a bunch of people are hiding out in that. And so they go up into the mountains. It's not certain whether the temple itself is a standalone structure, or whether it's the tower is a standalone structure or actually built into the temple. Abimelech has everybody in his army cut down a branch from Mount Zalmon, carry it to the tower, set the place on fire. Fire has come forth from Abimelech, consumed the inhabitants of Shechem, just as Jotham claimed would happen. The place of their revelry has become the place of their tomb. But that's not the end of the story. I mean, you know, you think about this. This guy, Abimelech is a king. He's proving to be a tyrant. Can anyone stop him? Well, let's keep reading. Then Abimelech went to Thebes, And he camped against Thebes and captured it. Well, why attack Thebes? Probably a nearby satellite town to Shechem. It doesn't seem like a necessary attack, but, you know, Abimelech is, I guess, has this lust for blood that proves to be his undoing. In verse 51, there was a strong tower in the center of the city, and all the men and women with all the leaders of the city fled there and shut themselves in. They went up to the roof of the tower. So Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it, approached the entrance of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, crushing his skull. He called quickly to the young man, his armor-bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, so that it will not be said of me, 'A woman slew him.'" So the young man pierced him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, each departed to his own house. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father in killing his 70 brothers. Also God returned all the wickedness of the men of Shechem on their heads, and the curse of Jotham the son of Jerubbaal came upon them. Now, and I mean, the text makes it explicit at the end. You haven't been hearing a lot about God in this story, but the text makes it explicit at the end that God is the one behind these events. God is the one repaying Abimelech for his bad behavior, for his wickedness, for his murder. Everyone hides in the fortified tower, and the reader already knows how the story ends. Abimelech's taken a tower once before. He tries the same trick twice. He's going to come up to the tower and burn it. But there's a woman in the tower who throws a millstone out of it, and it crushes him in the skull. This is a common theme in Judges, women crushing the skulls of military leaders. You see Yael crush the skull of Sisera in Judges chapter 4. And this anonymous woman crushes the skull of Abimelech. And there's sort of a poetic justice because Abimelech killed his brothers on one stone, and now he himself is killed by a stone. Abimelech survives just long enough to order his armor-bearer to kill him with the sword, because apparently, you know, he's still concerned about this after his skull's been crushed. Tells his armor-bearer to kill him so that no one will say a woman killed him. Just a brief comment. In the future, in 2 Samuel chapter 11, Joab said this, in 2 Samuel 11, in verse 21, "Who struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbasheth? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why'd you go so near the wall?" So apparently, many, many years later, they still say a woman killed him. Great plan, Abimelech. That worked out nicely. Joab attributes Abimelech's death to a woman throwing a millstone out of a window. It's also very similar to Saul, who said, you know, he told his armor bearer to kill him so that, you know, he wouldn't be made sport of by uncircumcised Philistines. And with Abimelech dead, you know, the army just kind of gives up and goes home. And no attempt is made to avenge their dead king, which might tell you something about how much they liked him. But there's something else going on here, too. I mentioned early in the lesson, what is Abimelech? He's a man who kills his brother. He is the seed of the serpent. He is of the devil. In Genesis chapter 3, all the way back at the beginning, God placed a curse on the serpent, the devil. He says in verse 14 of Genesis 3, "Because you have done this, cursed are you more than all cattle, more than every beast of the field. On your belly you will go, and dust you will eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, you shall bruise him on the heel." Now that passage, you know, ultimately looks forward to Jesus, of course. Jesus, who, being born of a woman, being the seed of woman, crushed the head of Satan in the cross, in the resurrection, defeated the devil once for all time. The seed of woman crushes the head of the serpent. However, here we have a man who is clearly the seed of the serpent because of how he's killed his brothers, having his head crushed by a woman. You know, it kind of flips the roles just a tiny bit. You know, instead of the seed of woman crushing a serpent, it's the woman crushing the seed of a serpent. But it's the same idea. And with God being so heavily involved in these events, I find it hard to believe that that's a coincidence. The brother killer, who was the seed of the serpent, has had his head crushed by a woman. What it says in Genesis 3:15, It's a truth about Jesus, but it's also a truth for all time. And it's a truth for us today. When Paul said in Romans 16 that the God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. You might wonder why a chapter like this is in the Bible. Just remind us something. Even when in the worst of times, even in the darkest of times, when no one seems to be good, when no one seems to have righteousness in mind, when all of the righteous people seem to have perished, and wickedness seems to reign supreme, is God still active? Is God still crushing serpents? You bet He is. Still works through the woman here. Crush the head of this serpent man. There's three practical lessons I would give in conclusion. First of all, killing your brother makes you the seed of the devil. And I'm like, well, okay. You're probably thinking, oh, I haven't killed my brother this week, so I'm doing good. Right? Well, John takes it a little bit further. In 1 John chapter 3, and I already read part of this passage, but I want to read more of it. In 1 John chapter 3, in verse 10, by this the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor the one who does not love his brother. For this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the evil one and slew his brother. And for what reason did he slay him? Because his deeds were evil and his brother's were righteous. Do not be surprised, brethren, if the world hates you. We know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brethren. He who does not love abides in death. Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. Now you start reading, it talks about, murdering your brother. It talks about don't hate your brother. And it talks about how he has the world's goods, sees his brother in need, and closes his heart against him. Let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. What makes us the seed of the serpent? What makes somebody a descendant of Satan? John's implying in verse 18 that it's a failure to do precisely that. When love becomes all about all talk and no action, when it becomes simply about word and tongue instead of deed and truth, we're riding that line of becoming the seed of the serpent, of becoming an Abimelech. That's scary. It ought to be something we pay close attention to. Secondly, of course, it's not enough, I'm not the seed of the devil. Perhaps it's not a good idea to be even in league with such fellows. The Shechemites were all about the politics of convenience. Abimelech is on our side. Ends justify the means. Would you take the shade under a thorn bush? Don't act like a thorn bush is shade. Do not envy a man of violence, and do not choose any of his ways, Proverbs 3:31 says. Do not let your heart envy sinners, but live in the fear of the Lord always, Proverbs 23:17. It's not enough to simply not be an Abimelech. We can't give our consent to the Abimelechs of this world either. And thirdly, of course, remember that God will judge the wicked. A woman crushed the seed of the serpent's head. The seed of a woman crushed the head of the serpent. And the judgment on Satan is also applicable to his followers, his seed, all who support them. Because the judgment of God is coming in this way, we have both reason to hope and reason to fear. Reason to fear because we don't want the judgment of God to fall on us, and so we must therefore endeavor not to be the seed of the devil, but rather to love one another with the fervency that God demands of us. And hope, because the Abimelechs of this world do not have true power. They will be consumed by fire ultimately. Even then, you see Abimelech, he sets fire to this tower. I don't know if any innocent people were caught in the crossfire, collateral damage and whatnot. But if there were, their cries were not unheard by the God of heaven. And these 70 men who did nothing wrong except be related to Abimelech and were killed on one stone, what about their voices? Who stands for them? Who represents them before God? Well, God ultimately saw. He heard and He avenged. And such it is the same way today. When people oppose the people of God, when the world hates the people of God and says to them, you know, you have no part in us, and they try to cast you out, ostracize you, persecute you, even put you to death, know that God is watching. And He saw who was right and who was wrong. And He will vindicate the righteous and punish the wicked in that great day. These are just some insights, observations that I make from the story of Abimelech. And I hope that this has been profitable and beneficial for those of you that are here this evening. If you're here and you're not in Christ, you have not been immersed into Christ, or perhaps you have fallen away from Christ at some point, or perhaps you're just struggling in your heart to make things right, and you need help. Stand on the side of Christ and not the side of the serpent. Won't you do that? All together we stand and we sing the song selected.